makes a difference. Rules determine which changes out of all conceivable options are actually possible at a given time and place. And that makes a difference. Information begins with a law of physics, the basic operating system of our universe. The laws of physics steer change down particular pathways, like the pathways by which gravity created the first stars. Information in this very general sense limits what is possible, so it reduces randomness. This is why more information seems to mean less entropy, less potential for the disorder that entropy loves. This is universal information. The rules built into every smidgen of matter and energy. No one needed to tell gravity what to do. It just got on with the job. In colloquial usage, though, the term information means more than rules. It means rules that are read by some person or agent or thing. In fact, by some complex adaptive system. This sort of information arises because many important rules are not universal. Like the laws of human societies, they change from place to place and moment to moment. As the universe evolved, new environments appeared, such as deep space, galactic dust clouds, and the surfaces of rocky planets. These environments had their own local rules that were not universal. Local rules have to be read or decoded or studied, just as you might want to learn which side of the road locals drive on before visiting Mongolia. The right, by the way. Complex adaptive systems can survive only in very specific environments, so they need to be able to read or decode local information as well as the universal rules. And that's new. All forms of life require mechanisms to interpret local information, such as the presence of different chemicals or local temperatures and acidity levels, so they can respond appropriately. Should I hug it, or eat it, or run? The philosopher Daniel Dennett writes, "Animals are not just herbivores or carnivores. They are informivores. In fact, all living organisms are informivores. They all consume information. And the mechanisms they use for reading and responding to local information, whether they are eyes and tentacles or muscles and brains, account for much of the complexity of living organisms. Local environments are unstable, so living organisms must constantly monitor their internal and external environments to detect significant changes. And as organisms increase in complexity, they need more and more information, because more complex structures have more moving parts and more links between their parts. The bacterium E. coli, which is probably flourishing in your intestines as you read this, allocates about 5% of its molecular resources to movement and perception. But in your body, most organs are devoted directly or indirectly to perception or motion, from brains to eyes to nerve tissues and muscles. Modern science is at the extreme end of a vast spectrum of information gathering and analyzing systems that begin with the simple senses of the earliest single-celled organisms. Entropy, of course, keeps a beady eye on all of this. If more complexity means more information, then when you increase complexity and information, you are reducing entropy and its accompanying uncertainty or disorder. And entropy will notice. Entropy is rubbing its hands at the thought of the energy taxes and fees it can levy as complexity and information increase. Indeed, some have argued that entropy actually likes the idea of life and may encourage it to appear in many parts of the universe because life degrades free energy so much more efficiently than non-life. Explaining the origins of life on Earth and trying to figure out if something similar might have emerged elsewhere in our universe are among the most difficult problems facing modern science. At the moment, we know of only one planet with life. Astrobiologists are searching for life elsewhere through the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI program. which began in 1960, but so far they have found none. For now, we are confined to studying the origins of life on Earth. Even that is extraordinarily difficult, as it means trying to determine what was happening on our planet almost 4 billion years ago, when Earth was very different. Defining life. Having only one sample makes it difficult even to know what life is. What distinguishes life from non-life? Life is as hard to define as complexity or information, and there seems to be a murky border zone between life and non-life. Most modern definitions of life on Earth would include the following 5 features. 1. Living organisms consist of cells enclosed by semi-permeable membranes. 2. They have a metabolism, mechanisms that tap and use flows of free energy from their surroundings so they can rearrange atoms and molecules into the complex and dynamic structures they need to survive. 3. They can adjust to changing environments by homeostasis, using information about their internal and external environments and mechanisms that allow them to react. 4. They can reproduce by using genetic information to make almost exact copies of themselves. 5. But the copies differ in minute ways from the parents, so over many generations, the features of living organisms slowly change as they evolve and adapt to changing environments. Let's take each of these features in turn. All living things on Earth consist of cells. Each cell contains millions of complex molecules that react with one another many times every second as they push their way through a watery, salty chemical sludge full of proteins in the gooey realm known as the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is bounded by a sort of chemical fence, the cell membrane, that controls what comes in and goes out. Like the walls of a medieval city, the membrane has gates and guards that decide which molecular travelers can enter and when. Cells really are like cities. In a book on cells, Peter Hoffman writes, "There is a library, the nucleus which contains the genetic material, power plants, mitochondria, highways, microtubules and actin filaments, trucks, kinesin and dynein, garbage disposals, lysosomes, city walls, membranes, post offices, Golgi apparatus, and many other structures fulfilling vital functions. All of these functions are performed by molecular machines. All living organisms depend on carefully managed flows of free energy. Stop the flow, and they die, like a besieged city starved into submission. But if the flow is too violent, they will also die, like a city under aerial bombardment. So flows of energy need to be managed with great delicacy. Usually, cells take in and use energy in tiny doses, electron by electron or proton by proton. Though small enough not to be disruptive, these flows are large enough to provide the activation energies needed to drive lots of interesting chemistry. Etymologically, the word metabolism comes from the word meaning change. It's a reminder that cells never stand still. Like birds in flight, they use flows of energy to keep adjusting to ever-changing environments. Living organisms must constantly monitor and adjust to changes in their environments. This constant adjustment is known as preserving homeostasis. To maintain some sort of equilibrium in changing surroundings, cells must continually access, download, and decode information about their internal and external environments, decide on the best response, and then respond. The word homeostasis means standing still, which is the opposite of change. But it makes sense if you think of standing still in the never-ending molecular hurricane of the cell's environment. Impressive as these abilities are, There would be of little interest if living organisms appeared and vanished like spray on an ocean wave. And that may be what has happened on some planets around some stars, and perhaps even early in Earth's history. But today, on planet Earth, living organisms don't just stand up in the hurricane of change and entropy. They also make copies of themselves, so that when particular cells fall down, and eventually they will all fall down, others can take their place. Reproduction is the ability to make viable copies of cells. Reproduction means that the template for making an organism, its genome in modern terminology, can survive even after individuals have died. Like an instruction manual, the genome stores information about the proteins needed to build a copy of the parent, as well as some basic assembly rules. Today, most of this information is stored in molecules of DNA. But early in the history of life on Earth, it was probably stored in RNA, a molecular cousin to DNA that still does a lot of heavy lifting inside cells. Though the templates are more or less immortal, the copying process is not perfect. This is good news, because it means the templates can slowly change as a result of tiny copying errors, and that is the key to adaptation and evolution. Tiny genetic changes give life its remarkable resilience, because they allow species to adapt to their environments by randomly creating slightly different templates. As environments change, so too do the rules that determine which templates will survive and which will perish. This is the mechanism Charles Darwin described as natural selection. Natural selection is a fundamental idea in modern biology because it is an extraordinarily powerful driver of increasing complexity. Natural selection filters out some genetic possibilities, allowing only those compatible with local rules. So natural selection is a ratchet, like the fundamental laws of physics, because it locks non-random patterns in place. But in the biological realm, it is the local rules of particular environments, not the universal rules of physics, that determine what survives. And the biological rules are much more persnickety. Don't expect a giraffe to survive underwater. Like the mechanisms that generated the universe's first structures, natural selection links necessity and chance. Variation provides multiple possibilities. Natural selection uses local rules to pick out those that will work under local conditions. Here is how Darwin put it in The Origin of Species. Can it be thought improbable that variations useful in some way to each being in the great and complex battle of life should sometimes occur in the course of thousands of generations? If such do occur, can we doubt, remembering that many more individuals are born than can possibly survive, that individuals having any advantage, however slight, over others, would have the best chance of surviving and of procreating their kind? On the other hand, we may feel sure that any variation in the least degree injurious would be rigidly destroyed. This preservation of favorable variations and the rejection of injurious variations I call natural selection. Darwin's idea, when linked to a modern understanding of genetics and heredity, explains life's creativity, its ability over many generations to explore possibilities, tap new energy flows, and construct new types of structures. It explains how, in the biological realm, structures of staggering complexity can emerge through repetitive algorithmic processes as they are filtered out from myriad variations, step by step and generation by generation, over millions and billions of years. The idea of natural selection shocked Darwin's contemporaries, because it seemed to do away with the need for a creator God. And that idea was fundamental to the Christian origin story that most people accepted in Victorian England. Even Darwin was worried, and his wife, Emma, feared she and Charles would end up in different places in the afterlife. But the mechanism Darwin described really does seem to be fundamental to the history of life. Let finches breed on one of the Galapagos Islands that Darwin visited in his youth. If this island's trees produce nuts with tough shells, over time those finches with beaks that can crack the shells most efficiently will survive better and produce more offspring than others. Wait a few generations and you will find all the finches on this island have this type of beak. Over time, as some individuals are selected by nature, in fact, by the rules of the local environment, a new species will emerge. Here, as Darwin showed, is the basic mechanism of biological evolution. This is Darwin's complexity ratchet. This is how life builds more and more complex things, step by step. The Goldilocks conditions for life. How did life first sputter into motion somewhere in the rich and varied Goldilocks environments of the young Earth? What Darwin did not know was that mechanisms similar to natural selection, in which random changes are filtered out by local rules, can also work in rough and ready ways in a world without life. Where there are complex mixtures of chemicals and plenty of free energy, molecules can arise that encourage the formation of other molecules and eventually create the molecules the reaction started out with. This is an autocatalytic cycle, a reaction where components enable or catalyze the production of other components of the cycle, including its original ingredients, so the cycle can repeat itself. Fire up one of these cycles and it will produce its components in larger and larger quantities as it extracts more and more food energy until it starts starving other, less successful reactions. The cycle may even modify itself slightly if new types of food appear. This is beginning to look like the survival of the most successful chemical reaction. So here we already have something a bit lifelike, something that can persist and reproduce by tapping energy from its surroundings. Before we can have competent reproducers, writes Daniel Dennett, we have to have competent persisters, structures with enough stability to hang around long enough to pick up revisions. This idea of chemical evolution will help us explain, at least in general terms, how the preconditions for life emerged on the young Earth. Chemical evolution can take place only in an environment that allows rich chemical experimentation. And such environments are extraordinarily rare. So what are the Goldilocks conditions for chemical experimentation? And why did the young Earth exhibit so many of them? First, our solar system is in the right part of the Milky Way galaxy. Stars in the galaxy's outer suburbs have thin, chemically impoverished clouds of chemicals to work with. Stars too close to the galaxy's central business zone are battered by shock waves from the violent outbursts of black holes that lie at its core. Our solar system is in just the right place. Its orbit is about two-thirds of the way from the center of the Milky Way, in the middle of our galaxy's habitable zone. Second, chemistry works well only at lower temperatures. The early universe was too hot for atoms to combine into molecules. So was the interior of stars. Rich chemistry is possible within only a narrow range of fairly low temperatures, and you find these in habitable zones that are close to stars, but not too close. Our Earth's orbit is in about the middle of our sun's habitable zone. Venus and Mars orbit at the inner and outer edges, respectively, of our system's habitable zone. But we are learning that some moons farther away from the sun, such as Saturn's moon Enceladus, may also have internal furnaces and chemistries that make them life-friendly. In 2017, scientists found that the oceans of Enceladus produce hydrogen, that gas that provided food for some of the earliest organisms on planet Earth. A third Goldilocks condition for rich chemistry is the presence of liquids. In gases, atoms zoom about like hyperactive kids, so it's hard to keep them still enough to hitch up with other atoms. In solids, you have the opposite problem. Atoms are locked in place. But liquids are like ballrooms, and liquid water with its whispering hydrogen bonds offers the best ballroom of all. Atoms can cruise, waltz, and tango, and it's not too hard for electrons to change partners if they spot something more attractive. The presence of liquids depends on chemistry, temperature, and pressure. There is a narrow range of temperatures in which water exists in liquid form. Most water in the universe is in the form of ice. But at these same temperatures, you can also find gases and solids, which makes for very interesting chemical possibilities. So we should expect the most interesting chemistry to be on planets whose average surface temperatures lie roughly between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius, the freezing and boiling points respectively for water. That's rare. But our Earth happens to be at just the right distance from the sun to have liquid water. A fourth Goldilocks condition for rich chemistry is chemical diversity. It's no good having the right temperature if you've got only hydrogen and helium to work with. And today, even in the chemically rich regions within galaxies, hydrogen and helium still make up 98% of all atomic matter. What chemistry needs is those rare environments in which the other elements of the periodic table are more common. In our solar system, such diversity can be found only on the rocky planets close to the sun, because the young sun boiled away much of the hydrogen and helium from the solar system's inner orbits, leaving a concentrated distillate of all the elements in the periodic table. As soon as the young Earth congealed, its diverse slurry of chemicals generated lumps of rock, solids consisting of many different simple molecules jumbled together. Earth's first minerals also appeared, probably in the form of simple crystals such as graphite or diamonds. In such a chemically rich environment, many of the simple molecules from which life is built can form more or less spontaneously. We are talking about small molecules with less than 100 atoms, including the amino acids from which all proteins are made, the nucleotides from which all genetic material is made, the carbohydrates or sugars that are often used like batteries to store energy, and the fatty phospholipids from which cellular membranes are built. Today, such molecules don't arise spontaneously because atmospheric oxygen would rip them apart. But there was hardly any free oxygen in the atmosphere of the early Earth. So these simple molecules could form when given a few jolts of activation energy. In 1952, in an effort to demonstrate this, a young University of Chicago chemistry graduate student, Stanley Miller, created a laboratory model of the early Earth's atmosphere by putting water, ammonia, methane, and hydrogen into a closed system of flasks and tubes. He heated the mixture and zapped it with electric charges, laboratory equivalents of volcanoes and electrical storms, to provide some activation energy. Within a few days, Miller found a pinkish sludge of amino acids. We now know that other simple organic molecules, including phospholipids, can also form in such environments. Today, Miller's basic results still stand. Even though we know that the early atmosphere was dominated not by methane and hydrogen, but by water vapor, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen. Since then, we have learned that many of these molecules can form even in the less chemistry-friendly environments of interstellar space. So lots of simple organic molecules may have arrived on Earth, ready-made, inside comets or asteroids. For example, the Murchison meteorite, which fell to Earth near Murchison, Australia, in 1969, contained amino acids, and several of the chemical bases that we find in DNA. Such meteorites were much more common early in Earth's history than they are today, which suggests that the early Earth was already seeded with many of the raw materials of life and quite capable of manufacturing more. But most molecules inside cells, such as proteins or nucleic acids, are much more complex than these simple molecules. They consist of polymers, long, delicate chains of molecules, and forming polymers is not so easy. You need just the right amount of activation energy, an environment that can nudge molecules together in just the right way. One environment on the early Earth that might have provided the right conditions for stringing polymers together can be found at sub-oceanic vents, where hot material from Earth's innards oozes through the ocean floor. These environments were protected from solar radiation and from the violent bombardment on the surface. They also contained diverse chemical elements, lots of water, and gradients of heat and acidity as hot, chemically rich magmas seeped into cold oceanic waters. Alkaline vents, which were discovered only recently, in 2000, provide particularly promising environments, and the porous rocks that form at these vents offer tiny protected refuges for chemical experimentation, like Miller's flasks and tubes. You can even find clay-like surfaces with regular molecular structures that can create physical or electrical templates on which atoms can be wrangled into regular patterns and held still until they form polymer-like chains. From rich chemistry to life. LUCA, the last universal common ancestor. Life appeared early in the history of planet Earth, and that suggests that creating simple forms of life may not be too hard where the right Goldilocks conditions exist. But identifying exactly when life appeared is tricky, because the first organisms lived more than 3 billion years ago, because they were microscopic, and because the rocks they were buried in have eroded away. At present, the best direct evidence for the earliest life on Earth consists of microscopic fossils found in Western Australia's remote Pilbara region in 2012. They seem to be of bacteria that lived about 3.4 billion years ago. In September 2016, an article in Nature described 3.7-billion-year-old fossils of what looked like coral-like stromatolites that were found in Greenland. If these are what many think they are, life must have begun evolving millions of years earlier than previously believed, and must have appeared soon after the end of the late heavy bombardment, about 3.8 billion years ago. And early in 2017, on the basis of fossil formations discovered in northern Quebec, scientists claimed that life might have appeared as early as 4.2 billion years ago. We'll have to wait to see if these claims stand up. Biologists don't yet have a complete explanation for how the first living organisms evolved, but they understand many steps in the process. Though they don't know exactly what it looked like, biologists refer to the first living organism as LUCA, or L-U-C-A, from Last Universal Common Ancestor. LUCA certainly lived earlier than the earliest life forms we've discovered so far, and it shared many features with the modern organisms known as prokaryotes, single-celled organisms whose genetic material is not protected within a nucleus. Today, prokaryotes are found in two of the three large domains of organisms, eubacteria and archaea. The third domain, of which our species is a member, is the eukarya. We'll never find fossils of LUCA, because LUCA is really a hypothetical creature, a sort of composite picture of the first living organism, a bit like a police sketch of a criminal on the run. Still, such a portrait might help us understand how life began. Luca might have been sort of alive, but not fully, somewhere in the zombie zone between life and non-life. This is not as evasive an idea as it might seem. Viruses are not fully alive because they don't tick all the boxes in our definition of life. They have no metabolism, and they have extremely fragile membranes, so it's not even clear that we can describe them as cells. They're little more than packets of genetic material that glom on to more complex organisms. They enter another cell, hijack the cell's metabolic mechanisms, and use it to make copies of themselves. When you have the flu, viruses are siphoning energy from your metabolic pipelines. But when they can't find cells to hijack, viruses shut down and lurk in a sort of suspended animation. Some cells live deep inside rocks and have extremely slow metabolisms. They survive on tiny scraps of water and nutrition. They may be able to shut down entirely for long periods, like the rock guitarist Hot Black Desiato in Douglas Adams's novel The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, who spends a year dead for tax purposes. The tax these organisms avoid, of course, is entropy's complexity tax. Luca might have lived in a similar twilight zone. Composite sketches of Luca have been built up identifying several hundred genes that are present in most modern prokaryotes and are probably extremely ancient. They suggest the type of environment Luca evolved in, because they tell us what sort of proteins Luca was manufacturing in order to survive. The composite Luca, or family of Lucas, because we're really talking about billions of them, could adjust to changes in its environment. It had a genome, so it could reproduce. And it evolved. Luca may have lacked both its own membrane and its own metabolism. Its cell walls were probably made of porous volcanic rock, and its metabolism depended on geochemical flows of energy over which it had little control. The proteins Luca made suggested it lived at the edge of alkaline oceanic vents, probably inside tiny pores in lava-like rocks, and it got its energy from nearby gradients of heat, acidity, and flows of protons and electrons. Luca's chemical innards probably sloshed around in warm liquids from inside the earth that were alkaline, which meant they had an excess of electrons. Just outside the volcanic pores Luca called home were cooler ocean waters that were more acidic, which meant they had an excess of protons. Like a charged battery, the tiny electrical gradient between Luca's insides and the outer world provided the free energy needed to drive its metabolism, draw in nutrients from outside, and expel waste materials. Here is how one of the pioneers of early life studies, Nick Lane, describes Luca. She, Luca, was not a free living cell, but a rocky labyrinth of mineral cells lined with catalytic walls composed of iron, sulfur, and nickel, and energized by natural proton gradients. The first life was a porous rock that generated complex molecules and energy right up to the formation of proteins and DNA itself. Though simple by comparison with modern organisms, Luca already contained a lot of neat biochemical gadgets, including many of the recipes for the metabolic and reproductive machinery of modern cells. It probably had a genome based on RNA, so could reproduce much more accurately and precisely than mere chemicals, and that suggests it may have been evolving fast. It was also using the energy flows it tapped to make ATP, adenosine triphosphate, the same molecule that transports energy inside modern cells. From Luca to prokaryotes. Luca and its relatives had already done a lot of the heavy lifting needed to evolve the first true living organisms. But Luca lacked a membrane that it could carry wherever it went, and a metabolism that was not tethered to energy flows near volcanic vents. Luca also seems to have lacked the more sophisticated reproductive mechanism that is present in most modern organisms and is based on RNA's close relative, the double helix of DNA. At present, we know what had to evolve, but we do not understand the precise pathways by which these things evolved. Explaining the evolution of personal protective membranes is not too difficult. Cell membranes are made from long chains of phospholipids, and it is not hard to persuade phospholipids to link up in layers that form semi-permeable bubble-like structures under the right conditions. Perhaps, as Terence Deacon has argued, autocatalytic reactions evolved and generated phospholipid layers, molecule by molecule. If so, it may not be too fanciful to imagine some version of Luca knitting itself a personal membrane. Explaining how cells evolved better ways of getting energy and reproducing is trickier. But the mechanisms involved are so fundamental and so elegant that it is worth trying to understand how they work. Evolving new ways of tapping energy flow so that cells could move away from volcanic vents meant creating the cellular equivalent of an electricity grid that molecules could plug into as they went about their work. Enzymes played a crucial role here. These are specialist molecules that can act as catalysts, speeding up cellular reactions and reducing the activation energy needed to get them going. Today, enzymes play a fundamental role in all cells. Most enzymes are proteins, made from long chains of amino acids. The exact sequence of amino acids matters, because that determines how the protein will fold up into the precise shape it needs to do its particular job. Enzymes cruise through the molecular sludge, looking for target molecules that they can fit onto, the way a wrench fits a particular nut or bolt. Then the enzyme uses tiny shots of energy to tap, bend, crack, or split the molecule, or bind it to other molecules. Most reactions in your body could not happen without enzymes, or would require activation energies so high they would damage the cell. Once the enzyme has knocked its target molecule into shape, it breaks away and goes hunting for other molecules that it can bend to its will. Enzymes can also be switched on or off by other molecules that bind to them and slightly alter their shape. And this is how, like billions of transistors in a computer, enzymes govern the fantastically complex reactions that go on inside cells. Enzymes get the energy they need to do their work from the cellular equivalent of the electrical grid. This is a system that must have evolved very early in the history of life. Energy is carried to enzymes and other parts of the cell by molecules of ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, and ATP was probably hard at work already inside Luca. Enzymes and other molecules tap ATP's energy by breaking off a small group of atoms, releasing the energy that binds that group to the molecule. The depleted molecule, now called ADP, for adenosine diphosphate, then heads off to special generator molecules that recharge it by replacing the lost atoms. The generator molecules are powered by a remarkable process called chemiosmosis, which was discovered only in the 1960s, but seems to have been at work since the time of Luca. Inside each cell, food molecules are broken down to capture the energy they contain, and some of that energy is used to pump individual protons from inside the cell, where there is low concentration of protons, to outside the cell, where there is a high concentration of protons. This is like charging a battery. It creates an electrical gradient between the outside and inside of the cell, with a voltage similar to what Luca may have used at alkaline vents. Special generator molecules, ATP synthase for the technically minded, that are embedded in cell membranes use the electrical voltage created by protons returning from outside the membrane to to drive nanorotors. Like rotary assembly lines, the rotors charge up ADP molecules by replacing the group of molecules they have lost. Then the charged up ATP molecules go back into the cell and wait for other molecules to plug into them and get the energy they need to keep working. This elegant cellular electrical grid is present in all cells today. It untethered cells from the energy flows around volcanic vents, allowing the earliest prokaryotes to roam Earth's oceans, scrounging energy from food molecules and using them to create ATP molecules that could supply the energy needed to power the cell's innards. These delicate flows of energy maintain the complex inner structures of cells, just as fusion maintains the structure of stars. Like fusion, they allowed the first living cells to pay the complexity taxes demanded by entropy. Because in cells, as in stars, a lot of energy goes into keeping complex structures functioning. But also as in stars, a lot of energy is wasted because no reactions are 100% efficient. And of course, entropy loves wasted energy. In both cells and stars, concentrated flows of energy are needed to pay entropy's taxes and overcome the universal tendency of all things to degrade. In living organisms, energy has a new function that we don't find in stars. It creates copies of the cell. These copies allow cells to push back against entropy by preserving their complex structure even after individual cells have died. Luca's descendants evolved the elegant and efficient methods of reproduction that all living things still use today. Those methods are built on a key molecule, DNA, whose structure was first described in 1953 by Francis Crick and James Watson, based on earlier research done by Rosalind Franklin. So much of evolution depends on understanding how DNA works that it is worth looking more carefully at this marvelous molecule. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is closely related to RNA, ribonucleic acid. Both are polymers, long chains of similar molecules. But while proteins are made from strings of amino acids, and membranes are made from phospholipids, DNA and RNA are made from long strings of nucleotides. These are sugar molecules to which are attached small groups of molecules known as bases. The bases come in four types: adenine, A, cytosine, C, guanine, G, and thymine, T. In RNA, thymine is replaced by uracil, U. And here's the magic. As Crick and Watson showed, these four bases can be used like the letters of an alphabet to carry huge amounts of information. As DNA or RNA molecules link up to form huge chains, the bases stick out to the side, forming a long string of A's, C's, G's, and T's, or U's in RNA. Every group of three letters codes for a particular amino acid, or contains an instruction, such as, "Stop reading now." Thus the sequence TTA says, "Add on a molecule of the amino acid leucine," while TAG is a sort of punctuation mark that says, "Okay, you can stop copying now." The information on DNA and RNA molecules can be read and copied because the bases like to link up with each other using hydrogen bonds, which can be made and broken quite easily. But they bond only in very specific ways. A always joins with T, or U in RNA, and C with G. Special enzymes expose stretches of DNA that correspond to a particular gene or code for a particular protein, and each base attracts its opposite to create a new short RNA chain of nucleotides that is complementary to the original chain. The newly created segment is then whisked off to a large molecule known as a ribosome, which is a sort of protein factory. The ribosome reads the sequence of letters in triplets and extrudes the corresponding amino acids, one by one, in just the right order to make a particular protein, which then goes off into the cell to do its work. In this way, ribosomes can manufacture all of the thousands of proteins a cell needs. The final piece of magic is that DNA and RNA molecules can use these copying mechanisms to make copies of themselves and all the information they contain. The bases that stick out sideways from their sugar phosphate chains reach into the cellular sludge and grab on to their complements. Thus C's always grab on to G's, and A's always grab T's, or U's in RNA. The newly attached bases attract new sugar molecules that link together, and in this way, they form a new chain that is the exact complement of the first. In DNA, these two complementary chains normally stick together, which is why DNA usually exists in the form of a double chain or helix, like a pair of winding staircases. It can be wound up so tightly that it packs neatly inside each cell, and it is unwound only to be read or to make copies of itself. However, RNA normally exists as a single chain, so, like a protein, it can also fold up into particular shapes and function like an enzyme. This small difference between RNA and DNA is hugely important, because it means that while DNA normally functions just as a store of genetic information, RNA can both store information and do chemical work. It is both hardware and software. And that is why most researchers believe that there was a time, perhaps when Luca was still around, when most genetic information was carried by RNA. Luca probably lived in such an RNA world. But RNA is a less secure information carrier than DNA, because its information is constantly buffeted in the violent inner world of the cell, whereas the double strands of DNA shield their precious information from the whirlwind outside. In an RNA world, genetic information could easily get lost or distorted. Evolution really got going only after the development of a DNA world, by Luca's descendants, the true prokaryotes, which dominate the world of microorganisms today. With membranes of their own, an independent metabolism, and more precise and stable genetic machinery, the first prokaryotes could leave the volcanic vents in which they had been born and cruise the oceans of the early Earth. They were probably already doing this 3.8 billion years ago. Each prokaryote is an entire kingdom of staggering complexity. Billions of molecules swim through a thick chemical slurry, being nudged and pulled by other molecules thousands of times each second, rather like a tourist in a crowded market full of traders, touts, and pickpockets. If you're injected into one of these molecules, you would find this a terrifying world. Enzymes will try to glom onto you and change you, perhaps hook you up with other molecules to form a new team that can cruise the markets looking for new opportunities. Imagine millions of these interactions going on inside every cell every second, and you have some idea of the frenetic activity that powers even the simplest of cells in the early biosphere. This is a new world and a new kind of complexity. Like stars and planets formed during periods of chaotic change, cells eventually settled into a sort of stability as they began to manage and push back against tiny fluctuations in their environments. Cells would achieve a temporary balance. So too would entire species and lineages and groups of species. But this was never a static balance. It was always dynamic, always maintained by a constant negotiation between living organisms and changing environments, and always in danger of a sudden breakdown. Chapter 5. Little Life and the Biosphere. From The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. To give Esther and Rahel a sense of historical perspective, Charco told them about the Earth Woman. He made them imagine that the Earth, 4,600 million years old, was a 46-year-old woman. It had taken the whole of the Earth Woman's life for the Earth to become what it was, for the oceans to part, for the mountains to rise. The Earth Woman was 11 years old, Charco said, when the first single-celled organisms appeared. Together, Earth and life make up the biosphere. The word biosphere was coined by the Austrian geologist Eduard Zeus, 1831 to 1914. Zeus saw Earth as a series of overlapping and sometimes interpenetrating spheres that included the atmosphere, the sphere of air, the hydrosphere, the sphere of water, and the lithosphere, the rigid upper levels of the Earth, including the crust and the top layers of the mantle. But it was the Russian geologist Vladimir Vernadsky, 1863 to 1945, who first showed that the sphere of life has shaped planetary history as powerfully as the other non-living spheres. We can think of the biosphere as a thin wrapping of living tissue, and the remains and imprints of living tissue, that reaches from the depths of the oceans to Earth's surface and up into the lower atmosphere. In the 1970s, James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis showed that the biosphere can be thought of as a system with many feedback mechanisms that allow it to stabilize itself in the absence of major shocks. Lovelock called this vast, self-regulating system Gaia, after the Greek goddess of the Earth. Geology. How planet Earth works. Life took some time to get going. So we'll begin by considering planet Earth as a purely geological system, like a stage set before the actors have arrived. That should make it easier to understand the complex dramas acted out later by living organisms. The violent processes of accretion and differentiation, which forged the young Earth, left a chemically rich ball of matter separated into distinct layers. There was a hot, semi-molten core, made mostly of iron and nickel, that generated a protective magnetic field around Earth. Wrapped around the core was a 3,000-kilometer-thick layer of gas, water, and semi-molten rock, the mantle. The lightest rocks rose to the surface and formed Earth's crust. Gases and water vapor bubbled up through volcanoes to create Earth's first atmosphere and oceans. Meteors and asteroids ferried in new cargoes of rocks, minerals, water, gases, and organic molecules. About 3.8 billion years ago, when the bombardment from space eased up, the main driver of geological change was the heat buried in Earth's core. The heat seeped up through Earth's mantle to the crust and into the atmosphere, churning up the material in each layer, transforming it chemically, and moving vast amounts of water and gas around in huge, slow convection cycles. Like the evolution of stars, the geological evolution of our Earth was driven primarily by simple processes that fed on an initial, non-renewable store of energy. Earth changed as it sweated heat from the core through the mantle and crust and out into space. Heat from the core still drives a lot of geology, and will continue to do so for billions of years. But not until the 1960s did geologists figure out how this huge geological machine worked. Their new understanding of geology was based on one of modern science's most important paradigms, plate tectonics. Humans have been able to visualize Earth's surface only in the past 500 years, when for the first time they were able to sail all around it. But most people continued to assume that at large scales, the world's geography was more or less fixed. Volcanoes might erupt and rivers change course, but surely the layout of continents and oceans, of mountains, rivers and deserts, of ice caps and canyons was unchanging. Some, though, began to have doubts. And just as Darwin showed that life had changed profoundly over the eons, evidence began to accumulate that Earth, too, had a history of profound change. In 1885, Eduard Zeus suggested that about 200 million years ago, all the continents had been joined together in one supercontinent. We now know he was dead right. 3 decades later, Alfred Wegener, a German meteorologist who had done research in Greenland, assembled a lot of evidence that supported Zeus's idea. Wegener published that evidence in 1915, the middle of World War I, in a book entitled, perhaps with a nod to Darwin's Origin of Species, The Origin of Continents and Oceans. Just as Darwin proposed that living organisms had evolved, Wegener proposed that continents and oceans had evolved by a mechanism he called continental drift. Once joined in the supercontinent of Pangaea, or Pangaea, a Greek word meaning all earth, they had gradually diverged and moved to their present positions. Wegener offered plenty of evidence. On a world map, many parts look as if they once fit together, something people had noted since the creation of the first world maps in the 16th century. Just before 1600, a Dutch mapmaker, Abraham Ortelius, commented that the Americas seemed to have been torn away from Europe by some catastrophe. If you look at a modern world map, you'll see that the shoulder of Brazil fits nicely into the armpit of Western and Central Africa, while West Africa looks as if it would fit snugly into the huge arc of the Caribbean. In the 1960s, geologists realized that the fit is even better if you focus on the edges of the continental shelves. Wegener showed that there were almost identical fossils of ancient reptiles in South America and Central and South Africa. The early 19th century German scientist, Alexander von Humboldt, one of the first scholars to write a modern science-based origin story, had also noticed similarities between the coastal plants of South America and Africa. Then there were rock strata that seemed to start in West Africa and continue in eastern Brazil without missing a beat. As a meteorologist, Wegener was particularly interested in climatic evidence. In tropical Africa, you could find the telltale scratches and gouges of moving glaciers. Could tropical Africa once have hovered over the South Pole? In Greenland, Wegener had found fossils of tropical plants. Something had certainly moved over long distances in the deep past. But it takes more than some suggestive evidence to make a good scientific hypothesis. Publishing in the middle of World War I didn't help Wegener's case, and the fact that he was German and not a geologist ensured that few geologists in the English-speaking world took his ideas seriously. Was it really possible that whole continents could plow through the oceans? Wegener had no idea what force could have pushed them around, and in the eyes of most professional geologists, the absence of an explanation was enough to kill off his hypothesis. In November 1926, Wegener's theory of continental drift was decisively rejected by the influential American Association of Petroleum Geologists. And that seemed to be that. Except that a few geologists were intrigued. A British geologist, Arthur Holmes, argued in 1926